are around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It's time for Light of the Prophets on Truth to You. That's truth number two, letteru.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter, and you can keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, mate.
G'day to you, too.
I'm going to go very, very fast today. We're talking fast. We're not going to schmooze as much as
Really? No schmooze. I want to? No,
of course you do.
Let's set a record straight very quickly. Most of schmoozing is your fault. I do enough talking in my everyday life because I teach, so the schmoozing is all your fault, and no, you will not turn other people against me like you tried in the past.
We're not schmoozing, and the reason is because we're in one of the greatest chapters of the Tanakh, and that is, of course, 1 Samuel chapter 17, David and Goliath, and it has, what does it have? It's got like 58 verses, I think.
Yeah, it's one of the longest chapters, I think, and the other one of the longest chapters in the Bible is in Jeremiah, towards the end. I think it's like chapter 50 or 51.
Oh, sure.
It's a very, very long chapter. There's several very, very long chapters. I think the chapter with the largest number of verses is actually Psalm 119, very long. It's divided up into like 22 sections. Each section is a piece of the Hebrew alphabet, and each verse begins with the letter of the alphabet. So it's a very, very long piece. We're going to just dive right into this thing. There's a few interesting pointers that have to be brought up here. First of all, this is a hero type of story.
It is.
And a lot has been actually being compared between the Greek legends, stories of characters, to what goes on here, specifically because of Goliath and who he represents. And very, very quickly, who the Philistines were. Philistines were a group of people who related to the Greeks. Mm-hmm. They came from Crete, from Asia Minor, from different places where the Greeks actually dwelt. Mm-hmm. And they came in boats, and they were actually called sometimes the sea people. Now, there are arguments who the sea people were. There's even an Egyptian reference to Peleset or Pereset, and they create an argument as this text talking about the Persians or the people of the sea. But in any case, there's some stuff about them. There have been images of them were discovered, or what they looked, and when the images were discovered, the people immediately went, Greeks. They looked like Greeks. Mm-hmm. They dwelt mostly near the ocean, and they're the arch enemy for a very, very long while. And I think it's very, very ironic, or maybe I don't even ironic. I think it's divine that really the biggest enemy at the moment that Israel has are what people call the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. So I have friends who try to draw lines in between, the period of the judges and just before the king to what we exist in now. And they say, well, we're probably just we're coming up to the point where we're going to reach the king and the end of all, because it's the elements are very, very similar. There's a very, very strong idea that, you know, it's called Maaseh Avot Siman Abanim. Tales of the fathers is a sign for the is a sign for the children. Mm-hmm. So basically, history repeats itself. There are some elements of the heroic stories here, as I mentioned, and there's a lot of detail here specifically about Goliath, which actually enables us to somewhat pinpoint more or less when we're talking about. And what's very, very interesting is that Goliath is also presented as a contrast to David. And the book of Samuel is full of contrast because it's a book with, I think, as I said, you know, the biggest developmental character that exists, mm-hmm. specifically with David. David's presented here as a full character, and he's the only character in the entire Bible that this is done to. Not even Moses, who was considered to be the greatest prophet of Israel. Mm. David is drawn as a parallel to Moses. Both shepherds go in to fight a great enemy, redeem Israel, but from a completely different, from almost completely different idea. But King David is so important that, you know, in other places of prophecy, you have where it says, you know, here I send David, my servant. You know, he will redeem Israel, and this is after the destruction. There were even people in medieval times that believed that the Messiah will actually be King David resurrected. Mm. Now, I didn't say that, but you know that was such an idea.
Sure.
This is why different kind of you find, for example, in Judaism, things that are very, very unusual, like Midrashim and Agadot and places like that, where there are these ideas of a resurrected Messiah and stuff like that, because you have verses like this.
Sure.
And the unfortunate thing is, and I'm not here to insult anyone, but I think the unfortunate thing is that you also have a lot of people out there who are using these Midrashim and don't really understand what these things mean.
Mm-hmm.
But really what it works is that it's a descendant of the house of David, so he is like his father David. He's a descendant, so he's named after his father mm-hmm. David, but it's not necessarily be David himself or anything like that.
Sure.
But in any case, David is the most highly developed character. There are some, not in the beginning, but there are some contradictions here exactly who David is there are two things. First of all, who slew Goliath? Because there's a verse later on in the second part of the book of Samuel about that someone else slew this guy called Goliath of Gath. So there's an opinion that says maybe it wasn't David himself, but it's probably a typo of some sort.
Hang on a second. Wait a minute. You can't just throw that in and then gloss over it. I am totally oblivious to this verse. Where is this verse?
It's in the heroes. It's in the end of the second book of Samuel.
Uh-huh.
It's in the list of heroes, and there's one guy, I can't remember his name at the moment, it says that he slew Goliath. Which some scholars try to use, this is why Saul didn't recognize it, because it wasn't really David, and people claimed it was David, it was someone else. You know, but you have this huge story here, and there's one verse somewhere towards the end of the book. You know, big whoop. And actually, the person who wrote the Book of Chronicles repeats this verse from the end of the book, corrects it, and he says it was someone else. Uh-huh. This is probably some kind of what we would call a typo of sorts.
No, I've got to find it. I've got to find it now, because I'm totally oblivious to this verse. This is in 2 Samuel, I'm guessing, chapter 23. There's a lot of names here. David's mighty men. Would it be in... Let's quickly find it, and I'm looking for the now the reason why Yoel is because I thought that Goliath's name was only mentioned twice here in this chapter 17, but you're suggesting to me that it is mentioned. So it's actually it's in 2 Samuel 21 verse 19.
In verse 19 it says, and after this was a war at Gov with the Philistines, and there's the guy called Sibechai Hoshati. Okay, but he killed the sons of the Rapha. But then verse 19, there's another word, Gov, with the Philistines, and Elchanan, son of Yare, Orgim. There's a very strange name. From Bethlehem. The thing is, he's from Bethlehem as well.
Yeah.
And he's Iguliata Gati. And he mentions Ve'etz Chanitokim no Orgim, and the spear, the wood of the staff of his spear is exactly the same description that we have about Goliath.
That's right. Now let me tell you something about that. And I know we're eating into our time, but I have to tell you this. I have to tell you what I've got here. The way that the New King James, the Christian translation of the Tanakh, the way it deals with this verse, Yoel, and I know this because anything that's not in the text is in italics. It says here that he killed, in italics, the brother of Goliath. They've inserted the brother of to deal with that problem, but that's not actually in the text. Okay, now we have to go. Well, now listen. Now we have to, because you mentioned Chronicles, right? First Chronicles 20, 5 and 6. So I'm just going to whip over there. First Chronicles 25 and 6.
There should be a correction there, if I remember correctly.
I think you are right. It says this. It says, again, there was a war with the Philistines, and Elhanan, the son of Yair, killed Lami, the brother of Goliath, the Gittite, the shaft, mm-hmm. and then it says the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. Now here, where it says the brother of, it's not in italics; it's actually in the text, right?
Yeah. So this, it must be. It's probably a typo, and there was supposed to be another piece there. And the chronicler basically corrected that and said, "Okay, there's a typo here," and they corrected. They recognized the mistake, and these mistakes can happen. I've mentioned this before in the past. When it's a mistake inside anything besides the Torah, then you shouldn't get too concerned about it. Mistakes happen,
Sure.
There's nothing you can do about it.
Okay.
So let's actually start diving into this. There's a few historical facts I want to bring up as well.
Okay.
So basically, the Philistines came from Crete, Anatolia. And they were referred as the sea people, and it's very, very important for the researcher because of the uniform that's described here that belonged to Goliath.
Right.
Oh, and by the way, for those who don't know, there's a fortress near the Valley of Elah that I actually went there together with Nehemiah and Keith.
This is where you launched into your career as a film director. Steven Spielberg, Yoel Halevi. So now there's a video of this because you directed this film and it's on top of the Valley of Elah. Now, we did go to the Valley of Elah when we were on the 3T tour with Keith Johnson. And I will get to that and I'll release that recording because we did do some recordings while we were there. But a fascinating place, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But you were actually up on top of these mountains, right?
Yeah, I actually should see the bloopers. They were amazing. We went up, and we hiked up there. It was very interesting. We had Nehemiah, who happens to be an archaeologist, and so he explained a whole bunch of stuff to us, and it was very, very interesting. And then we started filming, and unfortunately, Nehemiah had an eye infection, so it was kind of difficult for him to look at things. And it was very, very amusing, I have to say. But it came out pretty cool video, and I think the one thing that was really interesting is that all these little you look there and you have like these two hills and you have this valley in the middle, mm-hmm. which is can easily be turned into a battlefield, and you have all these little ravines, though, these little streams, and you go into all these little smooth rocks. I can imagine David walking down from this fortress they were in, going down, walking towards the middle, and keeping his distance from Goliath, which is, by the way, a very important thing, and I'm going to show a few tricks that the text uses. And basically, he pulls out and he starts throwing these rocks at him.
Yeah. He slings them.
He slings them, yeah. Which, by the way, there's a big argument here in Israel. Is rock thrown in slingshots dangerous? Is it deadly? And it's like, what are you talking about? Of course it's deadly.
Yeah, of course it is.
But there's a problem. There's a problem. People don't really understand this. You know, they're just so throwing rocks is legitimate. You know, no, it isn't.
It's a lethal weapon, and it's still used today.
Yeah, it's a projectile weapon of like any other weapon. You know, people think, oh, it's a gun. There's no difference between a gun and a rock. It's just the issue of a gun is easier to aim and fire, so a rock, you have to know what you're doing.
Mm,
Still, it's a projectile weapon. It's an advanced projectile weapon.
And David certainly knew what he was doing. Now, verse 4, I've got, and a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines.
We start at verse 1 usually.
Okay, verse 1. Okay, okay, here we go. Starting from verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered at, now where's this?
This place is called Socho,
which belongs to Judah, and they encamped between Socho and Azekah.
And there's a place until this very day called Tel Azekah, which is a very, very high tel.
Okay.
Which I actually went up there a couple of times. It's pretty amazing. All these telim, you stand on them and you can see everything. Mm-hmm. So when you think back about the way they used to signal to one another with torches and everything, mm-hmm. you could see it because it's like you're standing and everything around you is very, very low. Sure. So it was very, very interesting to see that.
And it says in Efes mm-hmm. Damim.
There's a place. It's a place called Efes Damim, which is a very interesting name. Efes Damim, the end of blood, or something like that.
Really? Okay.
Maybe it was represented as the last real battlefield, one of the last real battlefields, or something like that. I'm not too sure about this name. It's a very interesting name.
Hmm. Okay. So Saul was there with the men of Israel, and they were gathered together. They encamped in the Valley of Elah. And they drew up in battle array against the Philistines. And the Philistines, they stood on the mountain on one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with the valley between them and a champion.
And that's exactly what you see there, by the way. By the way, it also says that they gathered their armies. The Hebrew says machanehem, which means their camps, mm-hmm. which also means armies. And the reason it says one army, but a bunch of armies, because again, the cities the Philistines were working on were exactly the same pattern as they used in Greece. Again, history of Greece I'm not very good at, but I'm not too sure if they were still working as separate little cities, like, you know, Sparta, Athens, and whatnot, or was it still like little villages and warlords and stuff like that? There was one point someone started organizing the system, mm-hmm. like in every country, even mm-hmm. Egypt. Even Egypt was a mess until the first pharaoh stood up. But in any case, there were camps because they were basically coming from different cities.
Now, when I have to say this because you've mentioned Greece a couple of times now, and it reminds me, this story reminds me of the movie Troy. Have you seen that with Brad Pitt?
Unfortunately, I had the sorrow of watching 15 minutes of it. And I know exactly which scene you're talking about.
Yeah, okay, so you know the scene.
I know the scene, and this is how the Usos sometimes solve issues. Everyone thinks about the ancient order as being, oh, they're all bloodthirsty, and I actually heard people speak about, you know, the Bible is full of bloodshed and everything. It's true. But there was also a diplomatic way of getting around wars by basically appointing a champion who's mm-hmm. going to, they fight against one another. And there's another case that we have this with Joab and the armies of, what's his name? Brain not working. The armies of Ishbosheth and what's his name? Was Avner Ben-Ner? Yeah, Avner Ben-Ner, wasn't yeah. it? No, it wasn't. Yeah, Avner Ben-Ner. And I'm being slow today. They send out, you know, soldiers, and they have a battle with one another, and they all die. So this was a way of avoiding battles, and this was standard practice. Hmm. You choose your champion, and they go out to war, and whoever wins, they win the war. So there's another thing that's done here, which is against the rules, is that the Israelites decide to kill the Philistines. You won the war, okay. We're not. This is a completely different type of war, because they knew the Philistines and the Israelites were not the same group, mm-hmm. which means you can't trust one another. This wasn't, for example, Greeks who were battling against one another, but they had, you know, for example, there's a letter discovered when the Persians tried. Here's another movie, 300, another terrible movie. had the sorrow of watching the first 10 minutes as well. The point was that when the Athenians were not received a letter from the Spartans to tell them to join the battle against the Persians, what happened was the Athenians declined several times until they said basically they assembled a council, and because they have a mutual culture and a history and blah, 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 they'll come and help them out. Mm. That's the same thing. The Greeks fought against one another, and this is at least the way I understand it, because I did learn a bit of Greek history. Mm. And because there was a mutual culture, then it was understood that, okay, if we choose our champions, whoever wins the war. Mm-hmm. But no, these are two different cultures clashing against one another, and the Israelites knew very well the Philistines would not uphold to their agreement.
They won't honor the agreement should they lose. Okay, so that's interesting. That's
kind of reminds me of someone today.
Yeah, yeah, doesn't it? It does. But if we go down there, we'll be talking about that for ages. But coming back to Goliath, because in the movie, Troy, and you know the scene that I'm talking about, where Achilles is set up against the champion, if you like, this big, huge giant of a man who comes out and basically taunts the army and says, send out a man who can possibly go against our champion. Look at the size of this guy. But the speed of Achilles was too fast, and he did him in. Now this story, David and Goliath, is far more exciting, because it's not as if
you need to read the Iliad to really get the full story. There's actually, it's very descriptive and very detailed.
Is it really
the story of the Iliad? And there's a lot of interesting lines drawn in between the Iliad and what we have here, including the side, the champion battles, the replacement of clothing. When Saul gives David his clothing, we have a trick like this somewhere else as well. When Achav and Yehoshaphat go out to war, they try to target the king, so they dress Yehoshaphat as if he's the king of Israel, he's really the king of Judea, yeah, as a decoy. Same thing here, because, you know, this is a very embarrassing thing for Saul. He's the king, he's like, you're the champion, blah blah blah. And he's too scared to go out and fight.
And and don't we know from previous chapters that Saul is head and shoulders above everybody else in Israel? I mean, he's a big guy as well. One would expect that he might have the guts. I mean, this is a guy that ripped the oxen into pieces and sent them out through Israel and so on and so forth. And you'd think, okay, this Saul, you're our champion. Goliath is the champion of the Philistines. You guys, go on, Saul. You're the man. Go and sort it out.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't do it. And I think it's also very ironic. You know, Brad Pitt with his good looks and everything, and he goes out. He's Achilles, and you have David, who's a very good looking young man as well. I think someone was thinking of being into this one as well.
Yeah, I think so. But the difference here, Will, is that we understand that Achilles is he's a warrior. He's already a proven warrior. We know that about him. Whereas David,
there are differences.
David is the element of surprise, and that's what makes this story so great. So,
and also a very important element as well, if we were to bring this up, Achilles is a demigod. David is a human being, and this is a very, very important difference. There was a difference drawn between the Bible and the rest of the mm-hmm. ancient world, that humans don't turn into gods.
Amen.
And it's a very, very important difference that was emphasized by the Bible.
Yes.
And I think there was even once this belief that human beings turn into angels, for example.
And this is now we touched on this briefly just a few chapters ago, when the Israelites said to Samuel, we want a king like the nations. We want a king like the nations. And what did the nations have? The nations had demigods for kings, right?
Well, the gods were the kings became gods at one point. Mm. If you came from Mesopotamia, I think it was usually after the king died. And if you were in Egypt, then it's no the person's crown, he becomes god. Suddenly you discover his real father is such and such god. You know, whatever.
Mm. There it is. Now listen. So we've got Goliath, which in Hebrew is Goliath, right?
Goliath. Yeah.
Do we know what it means?
No.
Isn't that interesting?
I couldn't find any explanation to this name. I really looked for it. I looked in different places and could not find a reasonable explanation to his name. Okay, this happens sometimes.
So it's clearly a Philistine name. We don't necessarily have the definition of it, but Goliath is how you pronounce it in Hebrew. He's from Gath. Now, this is what he's got, Yoel. He's got the height. It says 6 cubits and a span. Now, in my conversion, that's about 9.5 feet. That's pretty big.
It's pretty big. There's also, I think, a version that says four cubits. Yeah, 4 cubits is 4 cubits and a half or something as well. So there's another version that was trying to make him a bit smaller, but still, you know, someone who's like 6'5", 6'6", is pretty tall for that time as well.
True.
Now, most of skeletons discovered, for example, in the Second Temple period, most people were like 5'6".
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so if a person's another foot taller than everyone, it's still, even today, you know, the average Israeli is about 177, 176. So I'm you know, several inches taller than the average Israeli. So it seems that the original version was six and a zeret, which is basically about half a cubit or something like that.
Okay.
By the way, there have been arguments about people that height at that time, and abnormal sizes are not unusual. In every culture, there were very, very big people. Mm-hmm. In the Talmud, they mention a man called Abba Richta. There was a man called Father Long Legs or something like that. You can translate it.
Oh yeah,
a man who was very, very tall for his time, and he was one of the rabbis. He was referred. We don't actually have his. Maybe his real name is mentioned somewhere, but his name was Abba Richta, and he was just considered to be a very, very tall man.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't unusual for you to have people who have like growth glands that don't function properly, and they just grow and grow and grow and grow.
Sure. Yeah.
And there's even a papyri from Egypt called papyrus called the Anastasi or something like that, from the Anastasi I from the 13th century.
Mm-hmm.
And it describes fierce warriors, I'm actually quoting, fierce warriors in Canaan who are 7 to 9 feet tall.
Oh wow. Yeah, okay. They're huge. They're basketball players, right?
Yeah, and I've actually met people that tall. I mean, these guys are huge, and they don't come, you know. You had that famous original guy who was really, really famous guy who was really, really stringy and long. But I've met people. I once met these two guys, and they were like really, really, really tall.
Mm.
They were like they were 7 foot something or other. And these guys were very, very tall, and they were well-built as well. They weren't just small and stringy. They were solid as well.
And that's the impression that we get in regards to Goliath. It doesn't say that he was solid, but you certainly get the impression when you start to read about what he's wearing. What I've got, it says a bronze helmet on his head, right, big, heavy, with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. Do we know what that equates to?
Oh, how much? It's quite heavy. It's about 125 pounds or something.
Wow, that's huge. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, as we read before. And his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels. And the shield bearer, he had his own shield bearer.
Oh, he had a massive shield.
Yeah, he's got some bloke to carry his shield for him.
Oh, listen, though, a regular shield, I mean, put this in the descriptions of the people of the sea, they originally had these really big shields.
Mm.
And it was Alexander the Great that changed their shields to be small, round ones.
Mm.
Originally, they had these big, long ones, and they were very, very heavy. Mm. So think about this guy. This guy is like 9 foot tall, and he needs a shield that he can shield himself. You know, going back to that horrible movie 300, you know, the Felnex, which is a real method of battle, mm-hmm. they had to be big enough to cover themselves in a way where if they, if they, if they, if they, no, crunch themselves, they can cover themselves very easily. So these were pretty big shields. And think about it that then back then the shields were even bigger because the war of the Spartans against the Greeks was hundreds of years later. So this is still when the shields were bigger.
Mm.
So these were huge things, and this guy probably had a shield that was probably the height of an average human being of today.
Probably. Yeah, that's how I imagine it. And it says that he stood and he cried to the armies of Israel, and he said to them, why have you come out?
Oh, by the way, very important thing. For you, notice the massive description here of his weaponry and everything, but also important, the iron spear.
Oh,
back at that time, the iron. This is when iron started coming into play, and this is one of the things that scared a lot of the Israelites, because the Israelites were still living in the Bronze Age, which, by the way, explains a lot of the issue of the Chronicles. Emmanuel Velikovsky once pointed out, you know, he says, you go to Africa, the people are still living and using rock tools and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the time it took for certain types of weapons and metals and whatnot, whatever, pottery and everything, to arrive in the mountain region, which was where most of the Israelites were living at this point. It took time, so the Israelites were still using bronze. It was very rare to have metal, you know, iron weapons and stuff like that.
Sure.
So it's pointed out he has this iron spear, and it's a very, very heavy head. It's a very heavy spear. So this is pretty expensive weaponry.
And pretty sharp, no doubt. And so he stood. And he cried out to the armies of Israel, and he said to them, why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you are the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourself and let him come down to me, and if he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. And when Shaul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid.
So he's very, very insulting. I am the Philistine. He's very, very condescending.
He's taunting them, right?
No, it's beyond taunting. He's being very, very offensive.
Hmm.
Yeah. And being offensive is part of the game, you know. It's part of how they used to battle.
Sure.
You try to demoralize your enemy by being very, very offensive. What I find very interesting is that, you know, he says, I am the Philistine, and you are servants to Saul.
Mm-hmm.
You're servants, you're slaves. He's basically saying you're anyhow a bunch of slaves.
Ah, okay.
You know, none of you can. He's being very, very, very spiteful, this guy.
But if he's, this is the first time I thought about this. Is he paralleling himself with Shaul? Is Goliath saying that he is the leader of the Philistines?
He's probably not the leader of the Philistines, but he's basically saying, I'm a soldier in the army, and I'm probably better than your king.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And that's fair enough, because it says that when Saul and Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were both dismayed and greatly afraid. So now David was. Now we switch scenes here. Okay, so there's the curtain on that one. And
yeah. So so you have now what's called an adversive vav.
Mm-hmm.
And David. It's not just and David. Well, why do we do this? Now, you know, one of the ways the Bible does is it gives you a massive turn. It's like someone turned the wheel suddenly. Mm-hmm. It introduces a completely different idea.
Yep. There we go. And so we have to
switch the story. We've set this, the background story, which is Goliath. Mm-hmm. And we've told the rubbish that he did and how impressive and blah, blah, blah this guy is. No. And by the way, this whole thing of him being impressive, for example, you have the story in the book of Isaiah. I think it's Isaiah 9, where it talks about you're forsaken the slow pacing waters of the Shiloh, and you're praising Ratzin, the son of Remaliahu. Mm. Where one of the comments I once saw about this was that, you know, people were very highly impressed with new technology and impressive armies and everything.
Mm.
And the same idea here, you know, God's going like, seriously? You're talking about height, you're talking about strength, you're talking about this, you're talking about that. And this is, by the way, as is a continuation to the whole thing of, you know, good, you know, kings that look really impressive. And if you ever look at the images, for example, of Akkadian kings or something, they all have these impressive beards, and they're all very, if you look at their arms, they're all very muscular and everything. And it could be that these guys were like 3 foot two and chubby with a scraggly beard, you know. But the whole idea was that this was the impressive kings.
Sure. You know? And so meanwhile, back at the farm, Yoel. It says David was the son of that Ephraimite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had eight sons. And the man was old and advanced in years in the days of Saul. And the three oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. Now, just a really quick question. Does that necessarily mean that they're aged 20 and above?
Yeah.
Okay, so the three oldest. Okay, the three oldest were over
20. Remember something, he's an old man now. I mean, he says, Zaken Baba Anashim. He's an elderly man, probably one of the oldest in the village,
mm-hmm.
which some people argue maybe he's somewhere in his 50s.
Mm-hmm.
It might be that he was much, much older than that. They were not a poor family, it seems.
Mm.
He might be somewhere in his 70s, maybe even his 80s.
Sure.
So even if we say he's in his 50s and say the average person got married around the age of 15, so his oldest son might be in his 30s already.
Sure. Okay, so that makes sense. And the names of his oldest sons who went to battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and next to him was Abinadab, and the third was Shammah. David was the youngest, and the three oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally
Notice the repetitive thing about the three oldest, David is the youngest, David is the youngest.
Yeah.
There's an emphasis here. It repeats itself at least twice. And it's repeated as well in the previous chapter. There's this whole thing, but he's the youngest. And remember, he uses the word in David, Huakatan. And it's the same thing here also with Jacob. He is the younger son, but he's the chosen one. There's this repeated idea, this repetitive idea of the younger son being the inheritance of the father, mm. being the continuation of the father. And I think this was also part of what annoyed the Ephraimites and the northern tribes, mm. because basically Judah was older than Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
But Joseph, his father told him, you're my firstborn now because you were born of Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was part of the problem, that they didn't like the idea of, we're not doing the same thing again where the youngest brother or one of the younger brothers is the succession of his mm-hmm. father, unlike what usually happens. So same thing David's emphasized as being the younger son.
True.
Solomon as well. Solomon wasn't the oldest son. Solomon was one of the younger sons as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he was chosen to be king. There's even a drash that says that Solomon was like 13 or something that when he became king.
Really? Interesting.
So
it says, so that's worth pointing out. David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So he's obviously not a stranger to the battlefield here. And the Philistines now.
I don't know if he's a stranger or not, but part of the problem here is that he's with Saul when he's in the palace. He doesn't go out to the battlefields. So now he's at home because Saul's gone to the battlefield. He's not going to endanger this young man for no reason. So he's sent him home.
Sure. Sure. But he's obviously, I think, probably he's taken provisions. I mean, it goes on in verse 16 that this has been going on for 40 days. And verse 17, then Jesse said,
40 days, classic number of sequence of things, beginning and ending of things.
True. That's true. Because, of course, we've got, there's very many examples and we better not get into those. But Jesse said to his son David, take now, for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves and run
to
your brothers
in the
camp.
By the way, 10 loaves,
mm.
There's actually an Egyptian thing that mentions that 10 loaves is what usually people took for one day or something like that. It says, 10 loaves, half a pound of barley.
10 cheeses.
A jug of beer was a standard wage, daily wage for food.
Oh,
10
sure.
loaves of bread. That's a lot of bread.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you have to remember... But you have to remember that this was a place where bread was the main food.
Mm, sure.
So this is sourdough. So it has protein as well.
Sure.
Cheese was a very big source of protein back at that time as well.
And it's interesting that Jesse says to take the 10 cheeses to the captain of their thousands and see check out your brothers and bring back news.
So, you bring tribute and that's pretty normal. It was pretty normal.
Yeah. And so Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with the keeper, and he took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him, and he came to the camp of the army to fight.
Yeah, there's this whole thing about Ve'et Arubatam Tikach. And he takes this thing called an arubah is something you give in, you pawn something in for something else or So there's a whole bunch of discussions about what exactly he took from them. It's not very, very clear. Mm. Maybe this was some kind of a slip or some kind of a note or some kind of a agreed piece of whatever, you know, maybe a piece of clay with a certain symbol, something mm-hmm, on it mm-hmm. that proves that David actually gave these supplements. The you know, it's not necessarily tribute, as I said. It can also be this he brought in food for the camp.
Hmm.
And this was something that, you know, there's a war. If you're not in the battle itself, you're helping with the war by supplying the troops with different things.
Yeah.
So it could be, you know, to prove that they actually didn't know, there's a war comes. You didn't bring us any supplies during the battle, you know, now we can trial you. He says, no, I did. Here's this little whatever, this piece of clay or something.
Like a receipt.
But it's like supplies. A receipt. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like okay. A receipt.
So there he is, and he left the supplies in the hand of the supply keeper, and he ran to the army and came and greeted his brothers. And then he talked with them, and there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up to the armies of the Philistines, and he spoke according to the same words. So David heard them. I love that sentence. So David heard the words, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, Goliath, they fled from him and were gratefully afraid. And so the men of Israel said, you know, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come to defy Israel, and it shall be that the man who kills him, that the king will enrich with great riches, will give his daughter and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel. Now I've got italics.
In italics, yeah, it's not there. It's not in the Hebrew.
Is it?
But it probably does mean it probably means taxes.
Okay, so it's implied in the Hebrew, and then so David.
No, I'm not saying it's implied. I'm saying it probably.
That's probably what it means. So listen, this is when I was rereading this, something occurred to me. I wonder what you think, Yoel. I wonder that sentence in verse 23, so David heard. I wonder if he's already decided what he's going to do, because the next
few verses. Yeah, he's thinking about it. He hears this and he's like, what's going on here? Who do you think he is?
Who does he
David,
think he is?
David is so full of belief that he's like, what? He's standing there, he's like completely bewildered. He's like, what's going on here? Who's this Schmendrick here talking? Who do you think he is?
So the impression that I get, Yoel, is he's like, right, I'm going to take some action here. I'm going to do something about this, and I've already made up my mind. But before I take any action, what has been said? And he starts to qualify with a number of people. He starts to qualify. Let's be specific. What happens when I kill this guy? When I take this guy's head off? What has been said by the king so that I can make sure that is what I claim when this has been done? And then David spoke to the man who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in this manner, saying, "So shall it be done for the man who kills him." Now Eliab, we spoke about Eliab a little earlier, didn't we, in the previous chapter? His oldest mm-hmm. brother heard, heard David speaking to the man, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David, and he said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle."
So now we get a glimpse into his character.
Uh-huh. And
his character is of a very demeaning, very narrow-minded, very nasty type of person.
Mm.
And this is why God said, I don't want this guy. He's impressive externally, yeah. He's nasty. He's vicious towards his brother.
Mm.
His brother's interested in helping Israel. His brother's intention is very, very pure here, but he sees everything in a very, very negative way.
Mm.
So he's turning around to his brother and he's telling him off.
But again, Yoel, it's also, I think he sees it as an attack on himself, because here's Eliab, he's big, he's the oldest son, he's the number one son, he's a big guy, and yet he's not going to fight with Goliath, and yet here is his younger brother, his youngest brother, who's actually considering it and inquiring with the men, what shall be done for the men of God. It's sort of an attack on his manhood.
Maybe.
Or at least his status as a soldier.
No, it's quite plausible, but I think that it's what you're describing is another part of what I just said, which is basically he's very narrow-minded, very, you know, he's a lot of talk, a lot of outside, a lot of exterior, mm-hmm. no interior. David is the exact opposite. He's the younger brother. He's not this scrappy, you know, strong man. He's this young, good-looking young man who's, you know, deals with the sheep.
Mm.
You know, that was kind of a job they gave for the simple-minded, maybe.
Certainly for the, so, for the youngest. And but it's interesting, David's reply, he says, he basically says, well, what have I done now? And now for him to say that, he didn't say, what have I done? He says, what have I done now? As if to say, you're always on my case. Now what is the problem?
Yeah, basically that's it. So we see here contrast, you know, massive contrast in between these two brothers. And this is why David was chosen and not the older brother, not Eliab, because Eliab represents the type of person that's a lot of talk and no actual action, that thinks badly of people and he's not the type who'll get up and do something. He's not a doer. He's a talker.
Mm.
And this is why he's not liked. Basically says a lot of noise, no substance.
So it seems. And yeah, we'll talk. And so David said, what have I done now? Is there not a cause? And he brushes him off. He turns from him towards another and says the same thing. He's still inquiring. He's still qualifying what shall be done. And the people answered him the same way. Now, when the words of David that he spoke were heard, they were reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him, and David went to Saul and said, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine. And Saul said to David, but you're not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him. You are a youth, and he's been a man of war from his youth.
By the way, notice what David did here. He's in the camp, and he's talking with people. He's going from one person to the other, talking, because he wants the rumor to spread. He can't just get up and say, you know, run off to the king and say, oh, king, I want to do it. You don't approach the king like that. But what I find very, very strange here is the fact that I think he's doing two things. First of all, David knows the king. He plays music for him. So if he shows up at the king's doorstep and says, oh, it's David, he will let him in.
Ah, but this is the question of chronology that we were talking about in the last chapter.
Yeah, exactly. But we look at the beginning of this chapter, and in the beginning of the chapter, David is coming back and forth from Saul's place.
Mm-hmm.
So what exactly is going on here? So there's a bit of a chronological issue here. But also, it's possible to say that there's no chronological problem here. What's really going on is that David is doing two things. First of all, he wants the rumor to reach the king.
Mm-hmm.
But he also wants to get people out of the gloom. He's trying to tell them, you know, oh, I'll do it. I'll do it. And he's spreading the rumor. He's making sure people know about this. Oh, there's someone willing to challenge the Philistine. It gives them hope. He raised the morale. Eliab does the exact opposite. He's trying to reduce the morale. He's saying, oh, who are you? You're not going to be doing it. Oh, you just came here to see the battle, blah, 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 blah. He's demoralizing him. And here, David's doing the exact opposite. He's going around. He's telling everyone, I'll do it. And he's making sure that people are up, you know, helping people be hopeful and faith and have a lot more faith than what they were having up to now.
Yeah.
Eliab, I think Eliab is really maybe a representation of some of the characters use as a representation of what's going on inside the camp, how people are actually feeling.
Mm.
And no one really wants to go out to war. And
that's an interesting
thing. It scares them.
Yeah, and you know what? Something else just occurred to me, because as immediately when David goes to Saul and he says, hey, listen, I'll knock this guy in the head, don't you worry about it. The first thing Saul does is, I guess he sizes up David and then throws a wet blanket over the situation and says, no, you're not the guy to do it. I wonder, Yoel, if he's done this a number of times, if there's been a few guys that have said, you know what, I'll do it. No, look, you're too – because the outcome is, if the guy that goes out dies – then they are the servants of the Philistines. And so maybe Saul wants to, you know, choose the man who goes out wisely.
Or that Saul is doing the exact same thing his brother was doing. As we said earlier, he's just being too chicken.
Yeah, true. That could be the case as well. And in any case, so he says, you're not
so able he's, to do it. Yeah, he's not, no. It's like when someone who's incompetent tries to get rid of the competent person, oh, you can't do it. What are you talking about? You can't do it. You know, don't try to demoralize me because you're useless.
Yeah.
And David's very persistent. You have to imagine the following thing. There's a camp, but I forgot to mention this is probably a round camp. It says here in verse 20, it says he came hamagala to the circle.
Mm-hmm.
So it might have been that there were these circles around the king. We also, again, have a description of a circle with King Saul when he sleeps outside, and David, they steal his spear and a jar of water or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sleeping in circles as well because he put the king in the center to protect them. So several circles around the king.
Yeah, good point.
And there's several circles around the main thing in the camp. And it might even be that they even had the Ark with them. So the Ark was surrounded by circles of camps maybe.
Oh, potentially.
Again, we don't know if the Ark here is not. Oh, no, it's not mentioned. The Ark suddenly vanishes for many, many chapters when we hear from the Ark. Mm. And you have to imagine, you know, what's going on there. You know, you have to think about David is very persistent. You can see in his eyes or even his facial expression. So, all you're not doing is like, no, I'm doing this. No, you can't. I'm doing this.
Yeah.
So he brings the uniform and he puts it on him.
Yeah.
And David kind of like, you know, he puts it on him and he goes like, I can't work with this stuff on me.
But you know, before we get there, we can't jump over this because we get a little bit of insight into the kind of man that David is, or the lad that he is, because he says in his persistence to Saul, your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went after it and I struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it rose against me, I caught it by the beard and I struck it and killed it. And your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. Moreover, David said, he said, Yehovah, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And so Saul said to David, go and Yehovah be with you. Now, what else can Saul say?
No, Saul hears, you know, this. He's seen this very young, this persistent young man who's telling him these miraculous stories of being able to battle massive animals. You know, lions and bears was, you know, bears were here in the land of Israel. Bears were still around until like the 19th century or turn of the 20th century.
Really?
Lions vanished. Lions were hunted down by different nations, the Ottomans, the Greeks, the Romans, and people were hunting the lions here, left, right, and center. But back then, there were lions. There were bears. Even to this very day, we still have certain types of wild beasts in the desert.
Mm.
But what's very interesting is that it's very rare for one of these animals to actually attack. So they only attack when they're desperate, which means they're a lot more ferocious than usual.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So for a lion to hunt, everyone knows lions are pretty lazy. It's usually lionesses that the ones that do everything.
Oh, that's a good point.
So it's,
well, perhaps it was a lioness. Perhaps it was. But in any case, you know, for a lion or a lioness to take a lamb, I mean, that's pretty serious to go after an animal like that and deliver the lamb. And this is what David's claiming to have done.
It's also possible that the word Ari here is a general name for lion in general, which also probably includes the females. It's probably most of the females. But he mentions the whole thing of grabbing by the beard. Bears usually don't have beards.
Oh,
it's usually lions. So this might be an actual lion. This might be a lion.
Good point.
And but grab a lion by his beard and go clunk.
Yeah.
You know, slightly reminds you of Samson.
Oh yeah,
who tore a lion into two. So
true. That's a very good.
It was probably a very symbolic idea as well. This whole thing of smiting a lion.
So Saul clothed, as you said, he clothed David with his armor. He put on his bronze helmet on his head. He also clothed him with a coat of mail. Now get this. So you know, Shaul has the bronze helmet. He's got a coat of mail, and he's got the sword. Put it all on David, and David tried to walk around in it, and he said, look, I can't wear this. I haven't tested it. So he took it off, and then he took his stuff.
Maybe not tested, maybe more like I have no experience using this type of weaponry and everything. By the way, the name of the word helmet, it's very interesting. In the same chapter, we have two different spellings.
Really?
The word is kova, which in modern Hebrew means hat.
Uh-huh.
Here it's actually used like the word kasda in Hebrew, which means helmet. And in the first time we have this word, it's mentioned as kova with a kaf. And then here it's mentioned with a kuf. And usually they say that when you have such an erratic way of spelling a word, it might mean that this word is from a different language. It's not from Hebrew. It's another language. Even today, you know, when we have foreign words, you always have different ways of spelling the same word. I mean, like these rules they started developing that when you want to spell the word turkey, for example, so you can spell it one way or another, but there's like specific letters that go with one another. So, for example, you want to write it as Tulkia, which is what we say in Hebrew. So if you write it with a kuf, you have to write it with a tet. And if you write it with a kaf, you have to write it with a tav. And this is why you have textbooks that if there's a textbook that talk about the Ottoman Empire, they'll mention Turkey in one spelling. But when they're talking about modern Turkey, they'll talk about another spelling. And it's like, ooh. But this is what they do. And you have music. From the word music used to be spelled in two different ways, one with a samech, one with a zayin, and there's a whole bunch of different ways of spelling. So this is something that was done even back then when he had a word that came from another language with different ways of spelling it.
HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com if you want Hebrew lessons with Yoel. Now listen, the first place that it's mentioned, are you talking about where it talks about Goliath's helmet?
Yeah.
So potentially the word helmet there is of a Philistine origin?
It can be. I haven't really found the origins of this word.
Okay, so that's interesting.
Yeah.
In any case, so he takes off all of this gear, and he took his staff in his hand, and he chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook. Now, we had the opportunity to do that. It was really cool when Keith took us to the Valley of Elah, and we found the brook, and we found a big pile of the smooth stones that get, as the water runs through them, and they all smooth out. And the interesting thing about that, Yoel, is that you could kind of size them up in your hand, how heavy they were, how large they would have to be to get a weight to be able to swing it, to be able to penetrate into a man's forehead.
Yeah, so
decent size.
You were there, so you can get something, if you remember what the size of things are, so usually the size of the pot that held the rock was about the size of an adult's palm hand.
Yeah.
And basically a rock that can fit in there can weigh anything up to about, half a pound to three quarters of a pound, maybe, yeah. About something like that. Decent size of a rock. And these things, when you throw them, these things go really, really fast. I mean, I actually knew some guys who were training with these things. They were actually built in making these professional ones. They discovered how the Arabs make them, and they started making their own. Because it was a time when there was a lot of rock throwing in the area I was living in. Mm-hmm. And people basically said that we reached a point that, we can't play around with this anymore. So they started working on these things. Now, actually, one day went out to a target to see a target practice. Mm. These things whistle when you use them. When they're professional and when they're good and they're used correctly, these things whistle in the air.
Yeah.
And the speed, you see these things like flying through the air. And if you have like a whole bunch of people throwing these things together, say for example, if you have the armies of the Benjamites and there are like 600 people throwing simultaneously, this is a rain of rocks, and this can kill. And this is probably the same thing that David had.
Just to remind everyone, because we mentioned this, I think is it in the book of Judges where it talks about the Benjamites who could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. So, yeah. I mean, it's a serious weapon. In any case, so he takes five, probably because he couldn't fit more of those kind of sized stones in his bag. He puts it in his shepherd's bag in a pouch which he had in his sling in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. So the Philistine came and began drawing near to David.
By the way, he's doing a few strategic things. First of all, he has the rocks in the bag, not in his hand.
Yep.
Goliath, there's a strategy here. Goliath doesn't know what he's about to do. He's holding a staff in his hand. Now, a shepherd's staff is a weapon. It's a close hand-to-hand, a close quarters, or not even close quarters, it's a close combat.
Yep.
Close quarters usually hands and small knives. But it's a close face-to-face combat with staffs. You can use these. And he's playing a trick on him. He's walking up with this stuff. He thinks that what's going to happen, they're going to battle face-to-face close by. Mm. So he's taking his time to get near to David. This buys David some time to see first how fast he is, how clumsy he is with his weapons, how efficient he is with his weapons. Mm-hmm. And he's keeping a distance, and he's seeing Goliath get up and start walking. He can see any weak points he has. He can see if he has a limp. He can see everything.
So he's sizing him up.
He's looking how long it's going to take him to lift his shield. All these things. He's learning his enemy before he's actually doing something.
And he's approaching him with the staff in his hand just to throw him off, that he actually has
some
decent. That's a really good point. I didn't pick that up. And the Philistine looked about and he saw David and disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and good looking. So the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Now, what does that mean, cursed him by his gods? Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, I'm not too sure if it's gods or if it's a singular, because it's Elohav. And Elohav is actually usually a singular for God. Using, invoking. So the question is, is he using the name of God? Or is he using the name of his God? And this is why your English says his gods. It says, because it says be'elohav, and it's not too clear who the subject is of the suffix here. Yeah. So it can be either way. It can be either way, basically.
What is
the point of, maybe he's saying, such and such, his God, will strike you down. Give me the strength to blah blah blah, whatever it might be. Hmm. Or he's actually blaspheming, and it's another possibility.
That's what I thought. And so, verse 44: the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." And Yoel, this is one of my favorite parts of the Bible. I have to say,
David doesn't respond. He's staying quiet. He's just staring at him. He's walking towards him, staring at him. David's not responding yet.
Yeah, and here he does from verse 45 on, and I love this. I really, really do. Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of Yehovah of hosts." Now, that's Yehovah Sabaoth, right?
Mm-hmm.
"The God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied this day, Yehovah, will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you and take your head from you, and this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that Yehovah does not save with the sword and the spear, for the battle is Yehovah's, and he will give you into my hand."
By the way, it's interesting. It says here, the last verse, it says, "Vidu kol ha-kahal hazeh." So kahal is assembly, like you translated. Kilo v'cher v'chanit Yehoshia Adonai. It uses the form Yehoshia, which is very, very unusual. So some people, you have the linguists that say, "Oh, it's an unusual, hif'il type of form." But it also could be that Yehoshia, he combined the name of the word Hoshia, which is to save, with the name of God.
Mm.
Though again, it's a little pun here. Yehoshia or Yoshia, okay. There's no real difference in between the two, but he's playing a word pun here where he says Yehoshia, like the word Yehoshua, but in a verbal meaning. He will save, but inserting the name of God into it. He basically used a logical, again, we don't know 100% if this is really what it means, but it's possible that he used a logical, grammatical, verbal form that would indicate not just a verb, but also who will be doing the action.
Excellent. And so it was when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to David, I love this bit, David hurried and ran towards the army to meet the Philistine. Then David put his hand in his bag and took out the stone. So there's the element of surprise that you pointed out. And he slung it.
By the way, it's very fast, very, very, very fast paced now.
It is.
Everything was slow. They're talking. There's this. And suddenly he's running. He's doing this.
Yeah, it's bang, bang,
very,
bang.
Very quick.
Yep.
It's bang, bang, bang. And there's a reason it's bang, bang, bang. Because the Philistine was convinced he is going to finish off this midget.
Mm.
And this midget kills him in seconds.
In seconds. So David ran to him. He put his hand into the bag. He took out a stone. He slung it. He struck the Philistine in the forehead so that the stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore, David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword, the Philistine's sword. He's got Goliath's sword, and drew it out of the sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it.
Yeah, so basically the stone probably stunned him to a point where he lost his consciousness and maybe even gave him a massive injury to his brain because it sank.
He's concussed.
Cracked the skull.
He's concussed.
He's concussed. It's cracked the skull, went into his brain.
Hmm.
So his frontal lobe is paralyzed. Again, I never learned neurology, so I don't know exactly what happens when you hurt the frontal lobe.
It's interesting that you bring this up because I ask myself the question, because it says that he fell down dead, but does that mean that he's knocked out or does it mean that he's clinically dead? I don't know. I would have expected that his heart was still beating unless there's some serious internal bleeding going on, Yoel. What do you think?
Yeah, so it's probably it causing to have a serious concussion. You probably can survive from such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of stories of people that got shot in the head and they survived and weren't the same person, but they survived.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, probably he has massive, massive concussion with internal bleeding His brain's damaged and everything, but he's not dead.
So whether he's clinically he's dead, dead or not, it's not necessarily, perhaps it's not that clear, but in any case, David makes it very clear because he goes and cuts off the guy's head just to be sure.
But he also does exactly what he said.
That's right. So true.
He didn't say, oh, I'll just bang, I'll just talk and talk. No. He's not just a talker. He said, I will do this.
And
he did exactly the same thing.
And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. There you go. And now the men of Israel and Judah rose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley and to the gate of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell among them along the road of Sha'arim, even as far as Gath.
Sha'arim, which means gates. It's very not too sure exactly where this place Sha'arim is. Up north, there's a place called Beit Sha'arim, but it has nothing to do with the biblical Sha'arim.
Sure. And the children of Israel...
Sha'arim.
They returned from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their tents, as you would. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem. Now, I love this because he gets the armor.
Jerusalem. How does Jerusalem come into...
I've got Jerusalem here, but it seems that he took the armor of the...
There's a question. How does Jerusalem come to play here?
Doesn't
he conquer Jerusalem later on?
I don't know. Can you enlighten us?
Why is he holding a dead man's head?
Oh, come on. That's a trophy.
It's unclean. It's a part of a body.
He's holding it by the hair and he's carrying around the trophy.
Yeah, he has this little trophy of his, which is someone's head.
Yeah.
And
big giant head.
Let me ask a very simple question. This big giant head. And the problem is that this head is unclean. How can he hold this? Goliath's sword gets kept in the city of Nov with the priests, where they had some kind of an altar there.
Mm.
You know, according to the rabbinic midrash, with the Mishkan, the tabernacle moved there. So there's a lot of weird things that go on here.
Yeah, that is kind of true. We will read about that later on, but I wonder if there was some sort of trophy. Chest, perhaps. We'll deal with that when we get to it. But in any case, he's wandering around with a head like a trophy. And into Jerusalem, he put the armor in his tent. And when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, he said, Abner, whose son is this youth? You know, I don't know who this guy is. Abner said, I don't know. As my soul lives, O king, haven't got a clue. So the king said, we'll inquire whose son this guy is. And then as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head. He's still got the head in his hand. He's still got it, Yoel. And Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? So David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite.
Yeah, so there's a question, you know. So he does know David. He doesn't know David. What's going on? By the way, your chapter 18 is in the middle of a paragraph in Hebrew, by the way, as you should know. It's in the middle of a paragraph. So the thing is that you're standing there. So there's a question of, did he know David? He didn't know David. What's going on here? And there's actually an explanation that says that the reason he asked was like, this was a complete shocker to him. He says, he's not turning around and saying, who is he? Like, you show me your ID or something.
Mm.
He's asking, who is this guy?
Hmm.
This is not the David I know.
Yeah.
So they start looking into, you start saying, you know, is there anything that we know about his family that's, you know, something that we don't know about them? And Avner says, I really don't know. This came completely out of the blue.
Okay.
They looked at this and they had no idea what was going on. Saul was not expecting this. He said, maybe he will defeat Goliath. You know, okay, cool. Maybe he's the only guy who was willing to stand up, you know, and say, I'm going to take care of this. And he actually does it. And beyond that, he leads the army at war against the rest of the nation, against the rest of the Philistines.
Yeah.
And you just stand there going like, okay, there's something we don't know about this guy. And this is why he's asking this question.
This is not the guy.
This is not
the guy I thought I was talking to. Who are you? Who are you? Trained you. What other skills do you have? What don't we know about you? Okay, I can see that. I hadn't thought of that before. So there it is, my goodness. So we managed to do that in a little over an hour. I'm surprised. I thought it would have taken us a lot longer, but this is one of my favorite chapters, 1 Samuel chapter 17. Next week is chapter 18, where Yoel, we're introduced into two more characters, and that is the son and daughter of Shaul, Jonathan and Michael.
Right? Yeah, yeah. And this is now it's becoming, now the story is really going to start becoming the story of King David and what happened with him. But we had to introduce him. So we introduced him in the beginning as being chosen by Samuel. Mm. He's the young shepherd boy and everything. And now we're introducing him as the warrior as well and a leader.
Yep.
And this is where the breaking down of Saul really starts. This is where Saul starts losing it, really losing it. Mm. But we had to introduce David. So there's two different introductions to the character of David here, each one of them serving a different purpose. But the first one is just the introduction of the person. Mm-hmm. We don't know anything about him yet. We barely know his name in the beginning. And then now we're introducing who David really is.
He's a shepherd boy. He's launched into hero status.
Exactly. And so the two different introductions, and there are discussions about why are there two different introductions of the character David is. Maybe there are two different storylines which were combined here. This is where you have contradictions, stuff like that. Not necessarily. We did show that this last verse that confuses everyone. These last two verses really are probably a different question. You kind of have to read a bit differently. Mm. That's probably the classic interpretation I grew up with. And it makes more sense than others.
I like it. I think it works.
But we do have to remember something very simple. And I did read this in several books that mention this, is that, again, the logic of the writers of the Bible, even if it's a contradiction, wasn't a contradiction to them. They knew it wasn't the same piece of information, because no one's that stupid. No one would write a book. If one person sits down and edits a book, and they're reading through it, they're done writing the book, and they're reading through it, and they start noticing contradictions, it would raise questions with people. How come we have these contradictions? And the answer is, there are scholars today who are saying that these were not viewed as contradictions. Mm-hmm. These were considered to be normal situations where they knew there were different stories, but they wanted to present everything that they knew.
Sure.
Or that there's some interior logic that we, with our Western way of reading things, It doesn't make sense to us, but to them it made perfect sense, and there was no problem there. Mm-hmm. So that might be why you have these contradictions. Maybe they're not contradictions.
It's a curious couple of verses at the end there in regards to how was David known to Saul. So anyway, listeners can take that into consideration and come to their own conclusion. But that certainly is chapter 17. Chapter 18 next week. Again, Hebrew in Israel. Don't forget the Facebook page, dear listeners, Hebrew in Israel. You'll find it on Facebook.
Yeah, but before we close, I do have a few requests.
Go on.
There's a few of them. First of all, I keep on getting these emails from people about the resurrection verses in the Bible, what happens after we die, stuff like that. Two very important things. First of all, the Bible doesn't really tell us what happens after we die. It says you go to this place called Sheol, and it looks as if you go to sleep or something. Mm-hmm. So please, the problem here is that there's certain theological issues that the Bible doesn't really tell us much. Also, I get questions a lot about the issue of resurrection and what happens and when will be the resurrection. These are questions that people have been asking for thousands of years, and the answer is, I don't know. Okay? So if there's anyone out there who still wants to ask this question, here's my answer. I have no idea. Or even say neither. I have no idea. That's number one. Number two, and I rarely do this, I do want to request people to actually pray for certain people here. First of all, my wife.
Oh yes.
She's got this really nasty virus, and she's losing weight, and she's anyhow very, very skinny. And if this doesn't solve itself, we might have to put her in the hospital. Nothing life-threatening yet, but it's becoming very, very scary. She's losing weight because she can barely eat this really weird virus. Also for my dad, he just lost his job and he's an advanced diabetic, so if you can also pray for him.
Sure.
And but these are two specific situations which are going on at the moment and personal to me. So
no, absolutely. So that's your wife, Yoel, and also for your father. But that certainly that your wife would be experiencing some relief from what she's suffering from, some healing, so that she can maintain her weight. That's very important. So if listeners would be so kind to pray in that regard, and also for Yoel's father, really would appreciate that,
because she really needs prayer. I mean, she's still working. And she's still going to work, but she can barely eat. Mm. And
So we don't want that to become serious and certainly a subject for prayer. Amen. Mm-hmm. Okay. And next week, 1 Samuel chapter 18. And thank you, Yoel. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom. Kol tov.